Radio, where gamers roll. www.d20radio.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Eberron Renewed, an actual play podcast where we play the games. This one's Genesis in Eberron. I'm Jeff.
And I'm Philip.
And it's just the two of us today. Man, I know no one listens to these episodes first intentionally, but if they do, we're going to seem like the least professional podcasting outfit ever. And that is saying a lot. Welcome. This is Eberron Renewed. We're not playing the game today. Philip and I are going to talk about the last arc.
It's true.
Those of you that have listened to the last, well, if you haven't, stop. But those of you listening to the last arc know that I have some things to say.
Yeah.
About it.
Yeah.
Mainly self-castigation. I believe that's the right word. Yeah. Okay. So let us begin. This arc begins right after the garden party, which was sweet and fun and adorable.
It was delightful.
Despite Aeris's misgivings about it and Reynard's delight in it. We all managed to have a good time. I wrote some notes. I had to stop taking notes when I started driving while listening.
That makes sense.
I guess it was a
good decision, though.
It felt right. So this arc begins with Aeris trying to make a shrinking potion, because a lot of our plan hinges on her being able to do that. We don't do a lot of Aeris kind of your traditional fantasy alchemy. It's all, you know, very mechanical. So
yeah.
Is the rolling the same? Are the skills the same? It's just reflavoring?
So there are three different skills that Aeris uses for crafting. Artifice is specifically for the sort of magical spell casting aspect of making gadgets. Mechanics is just traditional crafting and engineering. So anything she makes that is mechanical and not necessarily entirely magical, we've done with mechanics. And then alchemy is a skill from the Terranoth book that's specifically all about making potions. Probably in like core Genesis, mechanics would cover all of those things. But for the world of Eberron, where magic crafting is so prolific, we decided to break it out into the three. And Aeris is best at artifice and mechanics. And alchemy is fewer. I have fewer skill points in alchemy. Because we don't really do it much. Aeris has not made, Aeris took a couple of points in alchemy because she was planning to poison Vigo.
Okay.
Yeah. So after my first spent experience on alchemy after Vigo threatened to cut off Aeris's hand.
Right.
And so I went and spent points in alchemy after that session in order to make it possible for Aeris to poison Vigo. Well, in my inventory, there are several items with which Aeris was planning to murder Vigo at the first real opportunity to do so. Her big plan was actually to get him to ingest some acid that she had made. But yeah, obviously various things short-circuited that as Aeris's friends had positive effects on her and desire to murder things. And so, yeah, it's delightful and poetic that it came back around to alchemy in the downfall of Vigo ultimately. But we haven't, there's been no opportunity really to role play it. So it was fun to get to describe a very different kind of magic from Aeris and doing the traditional bubbly cauldron kind of magic.
Right. I mean, it was fun to walk into it as Hob and be like, well, this is new.
Yeah. I imagined it being like, I figure that it's a lot like the difference between cooking dinner and baking a cake.
Okay.
Because I do a lot of cooking and very little baking. And I usually follow precise instructions the first time I do something, and then I kind of have an idea of how it's supposed to go, and I can kind of adjust on the fly, and I do a lot of grilling, and you can't really say, well, I definitely need to grill this hamburger for X number of minutes on one side because the fire is going to be different every time. And so that's Aeris's artifice, is it's very improvisational. She adjusts stuff as she goes along. And I imagine alchemy to be very literally chemistry. And so if you get it even a little bit wrong, you turn your friend into an ostrich. And so, yeah, so that was why I had, like, she's got a really old grimoire of alchemy recipes that she acquired somewhere deeply sketchy, and an ancient cauldron that's rune scored and things like that. Mm-hmm. And it was a fun way to also just nod towards Eris's admiration for Tasha, who's the arch witch of the D&D universe. So that was a little fun opportunity. It was tempting to have her put on like a pointy witch's hat, but that didn't make any, I couldn't think of anything that would justify that. And it seemed a little sillier than where Eris is right now.
Yes. And as you said, Hob was turned into an ostrich by the first potion. I will, like, sometimes I forget that I am at Eric's mercy, and I'll be like, oh yeah, so that's funny. Hob takes a little drink of whatever it is. That'll be great. And he's like, well, roll it. No, please don't make me roll anything for this. Cause I believe that Eric gets anywhere from 25 to 45% of the way through his random tables before he goes, yeah, this one's good.
Yep.
And doesn't, I don't know where the 25% comes from.
Right.
It could be the first and last, you know, 12. But so every time he tells me to roll a D100, I think none of us know what's going to happen.
Right.
And sure. The first things you saw were like sparrow, ostrich, and dog. But then it's like worm and blink dog and dead. But Hob turns into an ostrich. I did not realize until I was re-listening today that the title of this arc was, I believe, Head in the Sand, which is funny for an ostrich. And then really foreshadows, and without, this was titled before we recorded, where Hob has his head stuck somewhere else. Actually, no, that's not true. Jeff had his head stuck somewhere else. So, but it works with Milo. We know that Eris has created a proper potion, and I assume Eric would not have let us keep trying. Eventually, I was like, all right, what do we do? Do we have to go buy one? Like,
surely. Yeah. I assume there must have been a limitation at some point. I don't know where that would have been, or it could be, you know, we spend, because each attempt to make a dose, at least mechanically speaking, takes some hours. Mm-hmm. And so probably at a certain point, we've spent enough time working on this that something else happens because we're delaying or maybe like that. I don't know.
I know there's a concept, this may be in the game, and I cannot remember if it was something I've listened to, either Critical Role or a podcast I've listened to, has a concept of taking 10, where if it's something that you could do and you don't want to roll for it, you can sacrifice time to say you've done it.
Yeah.
Which kind of makes sense to me. And if time's not of the essence, I guess that makes sense. But
this is one of those occasions, and it really wouldn't work with the way that Genesis is, but this is one of those occasions where you can almost see the argument for the GM rolling secretly. Mm-hmm. Because of course, without trying it, you know, Eris doesn't necessarily know did this specific one work.
Right.
And so
I hate so much the DM secret role.
I mostly do too. This is just one of those where I can see the appeal of it. I think I would still have hated it if Eric had decided to do it, but I can kind of see where that side of that argument is coming from in this particular occasion.
That was when we did the Pathfinder Second Edition special episode, which you can find on our Patreon. If you want to join for as little as $1 a month, you will have access to, I think there's more than one bonus play session.
I think so.
On there. But one of them is the two of us with Eric as GM and two friends, Mia and Legal Kimchi, playing in Pathfinder 2e. And there were several times where in the mechanic, this is rolled secretly by the GM, and I hated it.
The only form of that I've ever thought was kind of neat is rolling privately between the GM and the specific player involved, and letting the other players experience the tension. Because you can usually, you know, if you have a good group, you should be able to trust players to not meta it. But like, I saw this as an argument for death saves in 5th edition. So you have the player who's dying, the character who's dying, and step behind the screen and roll the death save with just the GM, so that the other players don't know how close that character is to dying, but the player themselves gets to experience the dramatic irony and the tension of knowing.
I like that quite a bit.
Yeah.
Cause then
I like that.
I mean, yeah. Cause you know, after your second 10 or above, you all of a sudden see your cleric stow their wand.
Yeah.
So we get the potions and we are on our way to we call Tarvel and we're like, hey, you're still in, right? And then we're on our way to Fjarlan.
Yep. Yes. To the Fjarlan to get.
We're on our way to
get some kidnapping.
And on the way, we get an unbelievably difficult perception check. We lucked into, I think it was 4 red.
Yeah.
Perception check. We see it. We spot it. It's cloaked. And all of a sudden, in the words of Eric, I know a Warforged can't be jacked, but a jacked Warforged lands on your boat. And I believe ultimately it became, he has like pistons.
Yeah.
Power, extra external pistons powering his punches.
It's like transverse pistons across where his abdomen would be. So they sort of shape like abs. I don't know what they do in that position, but
he's quick to dodge.
Right.
And it took a long time. I listened again today, and you definitely figured out before I did that these were bizarro us.
Mm-hmm.
This group was. And yes, so the Warforged lands and the skiff reveals itself, and there are two others in the skiff, a caster and an artificer. And we met Bizarro Jerry, and you Eris handled herself extremely well in this fight. The taking over
it went really well.
Was amazing.
Eric has, so the danger of giving me the options that Eris has, which are mostly given by the system and not specifically by Eric, but the danger of it is Eric also still gives Eris loot. And so the number of like gadgets and toys that Eris has is really a lot. And so, you know, she's got the goggles can commandeer things, and her gauntlet can just shut things down. And like there, she has so many ways to commit cyber warfare that it is. It sometimes feels like I'm cheating, but no, I liked that more than just shutting down the machine, is taking control of it and just having it dive. Cause I didn't necessarily as a player want to just kill all of these people, because I imagine that Eric has some kind of story to them. And I think it would be fun to learn that story someday.
Yes. I would love if things work out and Aaron is in charge and the Boromars no longer hate us, I would love to have a sit down dinner across from, there was a Reynard as well, even though he wasn't with us. There was a Reynard. He effed off in the middle of the fight.
Mm-hmm. Yep, appropriately.
Yep. Yes, I would love to have a sit down with them, and the tableau that might create a lot of fun. But what matters is everyone in the boat is dealt with by Eris, and we punch. When I was listening today, I realized, okay, I do this move way too often. I did exactly the moves that
you guys did. You really?
It's the exact same series of moves and talents that killed Ace two episodes later.
You got a combo that works, man.
It doesn't kill the Warforged, though. Warforged is you take out. Eris takes out the Warforged.
A-B, up, right bumper, man. It works for you.
Mm-hmm. It's true. I Hadoukened. You know, let's not talk about it yet. We get confirmation that they were hired by Alira, that they were... we have a long thing about, okay, but were they going to kill us? We hope they weren't going to kill us because we want to hang out with them later. We get no confirmation or denial from Eric.
Yeah.
And I'm a yawn. And we go. Wait, we are off to meet Tarvel, aren't we?
I guess so. We meet Tarvel
before we meet Vega, or before we meet Alistair.
That's right. Yes, you're correct. That's the order.
Because the next thing I have in my notes is dead pirate.
Yeah.
There was a pirate.
Yeah, we see that weird, like, Davy Jones zombie corpse thing that comes lumbering out. Man, I really want to know what's up with that, because, like, Aaron gave us weird looks about, like, just some, man, I can't, the problem is, where we are right now, things are going. Like, we don't have time to pause and hang out with the doppelgangers or investigate what sort of evil entity Tarvel has a pact with.
Like, right.
Yeah.
I'm actually double checking something really quickly to see. Sorry, go ahead.
It's really uncool of Eric to continue to throw cool hooks at us at a stage where the pace of the campaign has moved.
Yes.
Up so fast.
I'm just double checking. We are currently, 50 episodes past where the first campaign ended, and Eric is still throwing in some of the most tantalizing hooks we've gotten so far.
We could go spend 10 episodes finding out about the whatever the undead sea pirate is that Tarvel's got. Maybe Tarvel's working with Captain Copperbeard or Bronzebeard or whatever his name
was. Exactly. Like, who knows what Ulfin, like, how this might relate to our buddy and curse. And then, yes, the Bizarro us and other 6,000 things that... And just as a teaser, we've recorded the next session and he's still throwing things at us.
He's still doing it.
So we're never leaving this campaign. I'm sorry. Or I'm not, if you're having fun. I'm not.
I'm not sorry. Like, But
I'm not personally sorry. I'm loving it.
Yep.
Remember, like, okay, I distinctly remember us talking about campaign 3 like it was imminent when we were still driving to Mustang.
So long ago.
to record. Like over 2 years ago.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because his whole idea was it's gonna be shorter. Like this is gonna be a shorter campaign.
Yeah. I have had several Halloween parties at Eric's house he moved into after we had those conversations.
Mm-hmm.
That's how long it's been. Ghost Killer Halloween parties. Eric and Miley, Ghost Killer Halloween parties, just so the listeners know. Okay, where was I? We talked to Tarvel. He's still down. He's on board.
So we lay the plans.
And, you know, Jeff was really like, okay, we need to make sure that they are on board because everyone's on board until they see their tiny unconscious son.
that is the saying.
That's the saying. It's as the saying goes. Everyone agrees with the plan until they see their tiny unconscious son.
Yeah.
And then things can change. But everybody says they're good. We take off. This is where we go to Alistair. And he tries to recruit us, it feels like, pretty heavily to
work with
Fearlin after this is over.
The weirdest thing for me, and I'm really looking forward to getting the opportunity to like demand an explanation of him sometime in the future, is Trevor's this turn that Reynard has taken towards gung-ho house loyalty, where of course you want to work for House Fearlin. It's a great place. What is going on?
I mean, he did say, I can't remember if he said to us or on the air, but I believe it was on the air. He was like, he has a shot at leadership now. So he's like, that's all it took.
I would never have identified Reynard as ambitious. And so it's like,
well, Craven, it's like, well, ambitious.
I mean, I'm absolutely loving it. Like, this doesn't make any sense. It's just, it was so unexpected and a very fun turn that Trevor is constantly surprising.
Yeah. I am thinking of the wrong word. I cannot think of the word I'm looking for. Craven, I think, actually means like really scared. I'm thinking like
Craven is cowardly.
Yeah, shamelessly opportunistic. No, he's not ambitious, but he will snag, like, he's always grabbing.
Yeah, yeah.
As long as he doesn't have to work, that's what it is. Whatever is ambition without desire to work hard for it.
There you go.
Which frankly, nice work if you can get it.
Yeah, you know, just luck into a well-paying job. That's good for you, man.
Or be born into, in this case.
Right.
And increasingly the real case. Anyway, and we get an assurance that it's going to happen, that they will do their best to keep him alive. We sign a liability waiver saying, like, we won't sue if he's returned dead to us.
We might pay extra.
Yeah. He promises us he'll put competent people on it, and he does, because we get Vigo, and Vigo is alive and unconscious when we receive him.
With a nightmare sedative, which is
that's
a nice little touch.
Yes, he is having nightmares about his own death, vivid visions of his own death the entire time he's unconscious. I loved how Eris was like, this isn't enough for me. I need him to know that I did it.
Yeah.
And then
Eris has been holding on to that. Right. Like Eris.
Well, the Eris realization wants that she can send him stuff through the teleportation to taunt him for the rest of his time in the Dreadhold.
Yeah. And Tarvel had to go and ruin that.
Yeah. I didn't put together how devious that could have been when you said it out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, Eris would be absolutely horrible about it.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Eris is going to figure out what the mail system is like at the Dreadhold and whether they accept spiteful mail.
That's funny. We do the thing. Like, there's no, like, that's the next stop, is we go back to Tarvel. We put his son in jail and get his wife out. They have names. Vigo and Aaron swap places.
Yep. And it works entirely. Like, that was frankly shocking to me that they went without a hitch.
I was convinced the hitch was going to be once Aaron's on the other side, Eric starts to play a little more fast and loose with her mental faculties.
Yeah.
Having been isolated for all this time. But that didn't really happen either.
Hasn't yet. I would say that's still on the table, but it hasn't.
Yeah.
Hasn't at this point.
But, and I feel like this is where unfortunately I had to stop listening.
Yeah.
Today when I was going back through, I feel like I was like, we were doing insight checks. We were trying to make sure that she seemed all together, and did. And we had a reasonable conversation, talked about how she plans on like laying low. She's going to slay
like, queen.
Laying super low until it's like time, until it's like go time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So And then, as one astute listener, I cannot remember who, put in the Discord, as soon as we left, it was go time for her and Tarvel.
True.
Eric made that pretty explicit.
Yeah, he did.
Without being explicit.
I was going to say, yes. I know, that was funny. Yeah. And then we head home, you know, to stay together and be safe and not let anything go terribly wrong.
Okay, let's just talk out, like, as we're going home, we see... the previous episode, there was the quick vignette at the end.
Meanwhile, yeah.
Right, of Norsen Milhatch getting sprung out of prison, or kind of springing himself out. I couldn't quite.
I'm still a little uncertain of what the sequence of events were. And
because it felt like Flamehead showed up and one else also.
Yes, I definitely remember there being two people, and I still don't know who the second one is.
And then Eric said Milhatch touched a thing on his own wrist.
Right.
And the back wall of the jail blew out.
Yeah, maybe he
tried to escape from those two and wasn't able to.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I also don't know.
See, listeners, we're doing the same thing you guys do. This is the first time I think we've processed it on air.
Yep, and we don't have anyone we can ask questions of.
And he wouldn't tell us anyway.
Right.
But because of that, as we are flying back home after something really did go right and well, mm-hmm. we see a flaming monster with Norsen Milhatch at the end of a chain, and we can't just let it go.
Nope.
No one expected us to let it go.
No.
It's really like... Hob doesn't really have a personal iron in the fire, except for the fact that Hob is the guy that does the thing for the friends.
Right.
And between Milo immediately says, well, that's probably what I'm getting framed for. And I didn't even think about Harbin until you said something. And I was like, all right, well, here we go.
Yeah, I would love to say that at some point after Eris is relieved that also we've cleared Milo's name. But that's not what motivated Eris to swing the skiff around.
Right. And so we go and start to fight this guy. And he's strong and he talks to us, tells us he's super powerful. He's a billion years old. And he attacks Eris. Did we swing first? We swung first.
It was obvious we were going to swing first. And so we had to roll initiative. We didn't get a surprise round. And he beat our initiative with both of his initiative slots.
Yes.
So yeah, he got to get some real good hits in before we got to do anything.
Yes. And he did do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Eris was taken down to I think I was down to 3 wounds at some point in the fight. Like it was real bad, real fast for Eris.
And so I did the thing that I do where I double or nothing. Did. And mm-hmm. then I got enough advantage to Key Monk, and I did that. And then at this so there comes a point where Jeff stares at Hob's fists and stops thinking about anything else. Didn't think about anything that had happened in the past. Didn't think about the fact that we even might have said Ace's name at some point. Didn't think about the fact that Ace wasn't at the four sales when we went there. When you have a hammer, I nailed that guy.
You did. Real good. Real good.
And there's no coming back from hole through the chest. It was a plus 50, right? It was a plus 50.
Plus 50. And you rolled.
And I rolled a 90.
92. And I mean, somewhere in my head, when we were talking that out, I was thinking, this is going to be Ace. But also, you had to roll that 90 or up for this to be what happened.
Yes.
And so the odds of that were low. And so it just didn't. I was like, man, this is going to be great. You're going to really mess him up. And it did not occur to me that until we rolled the 92. And then I realized, you can hear it on the recording. I switched. No. Because that's when it clicked to me. This thing that we just got really excited about doing is going to kill Ace.
Yes. And as soon as honestly, it was Eric narrated the death, one, without asking me how it went, which he typically does. And two, so quickly, I was like, I see what I've done now. And I think you can hear on the record. I mean, I don't know. Again, I haven't listened to the final. I was very upset with myself.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's evident on the recording. Okay. I listened to this one before our last recording session. It is evident that, you can hear you leave.
I do that. I leave, I walk off. I'm very upset with myself. again, I don't know what's in the recording, so I'm sorry if I'm rehashing things, but like I start saying like, I knew this, I knew better, I know better. I legitimately did. I said in the Discord, by the way, if you'd like to join the Discord, there's a link on our Facebook page, on our merch page, all over our socials, Geek Pantheon, at the Geek Pantheon on all the socials. In the Discord, I did not go to the Eberron Renewed discussion channel the day that episode came out until I had talked to Eric, and I went to see my kid in a play that night. And I was like, hey, so I have not been in the channel. He's like, it's not that bad. And that's when I went and loved. I did appreciate all of the Hob did what was right at the time love, because Jeff did not feel that way at all for a
while. Yeah.
Still doesn't.
Well, as we said, there was, well, as you kind of dealt with this in the episode, with this kind of how Hob talks himself down, there was nothing, you know, we know, because we know who Ghost Rider is and we can see all of the signs. But that's not like our characters know who Ghost Rider is. So there, and the bike wasn't present in the scene. If we had pulled up and the bike was sitting there, we might have put two and two together reasonably. But there's just nothing by which we could go, Hob would know this is an innocent in some capacity.
Right.
And why would Hob go easy on that guy? That guy just really messed Eris up. And if he gets another turn, he's going to really mess somebody else up.
Oh, yeah. Yes, absolutely. And I had just hit him, so it would have been me, because he seems to be like, that seemed to be his combat MO. It's, you know, turn where you just got hit from. Yeah, so Eric does something sad. I'm not going to rehash it here. There's no point in talking about what Ace's last words were. As Hob pulls his hands from through Ace, Ace says, I just wanted to help.
Yep.
I believe.
And I just wanted to help.
Yeah.
Did you see the wildly unsympathetic Ace puns on the Discord?
I'm sure I did and didn't realize. I may not have been in the mood.
Something
about having an ace up my sleeve.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Flame 112. Looks like Hob was keeping I feel like you got to put the CSI sunglasses on.
Absolutely.
Ace up his sleeve for this fight.
Yeah.
And then Kevin had really punched that card.
Okay.
Yep.
Very good. Thank you, everyone.
Yeah, so it was real good.
Yeah, this is every once in a while we'll do an episode where all of the discussion is behind spoiler bars, and this is it's just a field of black and no text for a while. And then yes, I came in and I was like, I really was concerned about looking in here, and everybody was very kind about.
Yeah.
You know. So let's continue with the narrative.
Yep, sure.
As Ace dies, several people who could have potentially prevented such things from happening also make themselves known. The most culpable, I would say, being Kath.
100%. It's entirely Kath's fault.
Like, Verla could not have actually said, hey, stop, that's Ace, because she didn't know.
Right. Right.
But she could have said, hey, I saw that too. You don't need to do this to clear your name. Not that she would have thought that's what we were doing. Not the point. Eric knew, and that's all that matters.
That's right. It's absolutely Kath's fault.
Yeah, it feels like it's 100% Kath's fault.
Yeah.
Even to the point, did you pick up the vibe that Kath introduced Ace to this opportunity?
Yeah, I mean, it seemed like I didn't think that she introduced him to like the pact, because we played that scene. Eric made me play the devil.
That's right. I recall that, a very slick devil too.
Yeah, thank you. And yeah, so we had played that out, but absolutely the Ace showed up. It's like, I have superpowers, let me help. And Kath was definitely apparently like, well, sure, join my vigilante murder crusade.
Exactly. Did you? Yeah. And didn't tell us, hey, these never said that it gives him these abilities. Now, okay, we will eventually have to unpack, not as characters, maybe just ourselves with Eric on like a final review or something, how much agency did Ace have when he was Skullhead? Because that's going to go a long way towards making me feel better or worse. But if he, the way it really will play out is if he knew he could do this when he was talking to us about the motorcycle and didn't mention it.
Right.
Brother, you weren't trying to help then, because that would have been a big thing to tell us.
Yeah. No. So just to pile on, Kath's relatives work with the Gashkala combating fiends. And so you're deeply
Kath
inexperienced
because of fiends.
Yep. You're deeply inexperienced, incompetent waiter friend shows up and says, I have been possessed by a fiend and I don't know what to do with my power. And you don't say, wow, conveniently, I am from a family of exorcists. Let's get your problem to an expert and take care of it. It was cool. Let's use your power. Cass' fault. 100% Cass' fault. Eris has frequently jumped the gun. I mean, Eris has been unfair in the way that she yells at people frequently in this campaign, not at the way she yells at Cath. I think every time Eris has lost her temper and yelled at Cath, she has been 100% justified. Cath absolutely deserved it, and Cath should feel terrible. And I hope she does.
I think Cath should feel pretty bad about this one. Yes, I'm glad we can agree that this is all Cath's fault.
Yep, 100%.
There's going to need to be a reckoning on that, obviously.
Yeah, I feel like that is what, like, there's going to be some loose ends mm-hmm. when this is over. And I feel like that's got to be one that we do something with. Although it's going to have to, the impetus is going to have to come from somewhere other than Eris, because Eris is at this point pretty content to say, Cath's dead to me.
Yeah, that makes sense for Eris. It takes Hob a lot longer to say that about people.
Sure. Hob is a better adjusted, more mature human.
I don't know. I think Hob's a larger and therefore more effective doormat in a lot of ways as well. I almost spoiled next week's episode.
Yeah.
Talking about something. I don't think saying that is a spoiler, because I don't think people are going to be surprised we deal with Ace's death in the next episodes.
Right. Right. Yeah.
I literally say I'm going to talk to Ulfin and Sana. But so Cath yells at us for that and then runs off. And Verla kind of does her much more emotionally mature thing. Much more emotionally mature than us as well. Thing
that is, that's
true. I can admit when if I'm going to take the time to say all the dumb stuff Eric's NPCs do, I will absolutely give him credit for being the grown up in the room.
Yeah, Verla is very much the grown up in the room. This is a much different relationship than the one between Batman and Commissioner Gordon. We are not Verla's peers.
Yeah, we are. If like Freakazoid had a Commissioner Gordon character, we're Animaniacs and the Doctor. And then after all the talk that we had about wanting to stay together, we absolutely split up. I mean, things changed, obviously. I didn't realize when we were in the moment that I did not narrate Hob telling anyone anything. He just dipped. I think he eventually led to
this. I think that's right.
This may be very beginning of next episode. I'm sorry.
That's possible.
But let you know where he's going. But takes off, and there's a question about it, so I won't go too deeply into it, but that idea of absolution doesn't exist in the blood of Vol, so he does not know what to do with himself.
Sure.
One of the comforts of religion is you have a system for, even if it just makes you feel a little bit better, your absolution is there, you know, the confession or whatever, prayer, supplication, whatever it may be. And Hobbs is just like, well, you live with it and deal with it. And so he chose to deal with it with the least offensive mind-altering substance he could think of, caffeine.
That's it.
And that's it. Hobbs not interested in feeling better. Hobbs interested in moving through, I think.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. Again, partly because he's able to rationalize it.
Mm-hmm.
He's not happy about it, but he's able to rationalize it. So there was a part of me that kept thinking that Eric was going to give a chance to just like get jumped or something, just to feel a little bit, get roughed up. You know, what they would do in a movie.
Yeah,
like or like a serialized television show. Like the last scene would be like Hob getting punched in the chest and smiling a little bit. You know. And,
yeah.
Eric did not give me that easy.
Yeah.
Milo goes to the Soaring Spirits.
Yep.
Chats with the bartender, grabs a drink, goes to the closet to fall asleep.
Yeah, that was a very kind bit from Yorlin, but it was, if I wasn't sure where this was going. I really thought we might be getting into another horrible trap, because Milo is so prone to get ambushed by eldritch horrors. But yeah, it turns out okay. Milo benefits from the kindness of acquaintances.
Well, and with some of Milo's rash decision making lately revolving around justice and retribution, we're lucky that he was sad. He was just sad and wanted to go be sad.
Yeah.
I don't know if Randy absolutely would have thought about that. I mean, I think we were all genuinely a little sad.
Like, yeah. Yeah.
I thought, cards on the table, I loved Ace. I thought Ace was a fun character to interact with.
Eric, I enjoyed him. I enjoyed every time Ace showed up. The fact that we had a fan.
The annoying little brother aspect of it
was
fun to play along with. If I had thought for a second that it was Ace, I would have betrayed my character and pulled a punch.
Right.
It just did not come into my head at the moment, and you gotta face the consequences.
Here it is, yep.
Is this potential spoilers for campaign one? Skip like 30 seconds or something. Did we have anything quite that? I mean, we had losses in campaign one, but anything like at our hand that badly like that?
I don't think so. This doesn't really count because it was also a way of exiting a character from the story. There's sort of that level of betrayal feeling when we all take the deals with Belashira and Drakir leaves. Sure. But I really don't think we killed anyone and then suddenly realized we needed to feel bad about it.
Right.
Like I think that,
and I will say the Belashira thing was definitely you pissing off you.
So yeah. Right. So that doesn't really, yeah, that's not nearly as bad.
Well, and to be fair, as much as we like Ace, Kath, Sana, all of them, none of them are in the team to the level that the Borrowed Time crew was.
Right.
It felt that way for a while. They were 100 episodes ago, 60 episodes ago, but we've gone so far afield and gotten fights, and they've gotten their own lives as they should. So what does Eris do?
Eris goes back to the cauldron, drops her stuff, and climbs into Olive's bed to just be not alone was what I really wanted from that. Is just Eris is not good at processing, as we've well established. And so she's not going to go try to, she doesn't want to talk about it. She's decided that she's going to process by being mad at Kath and blaming Kath for it. And since she's been mad at Kath for a while now, that works pretty well. And so just needing some closeness and some contact is what brings her to cuddle up with Olive.
I think that's fantastic.
Yeah.
And that is where we leave the story for a couple of weeks. Like I said, we have recorded the next two to three episodes, depending on how Eric divides
them. Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, we had a really long session. I don't know how Eric's going to cut it up.
And so you'll see what happens, friends. We're going to answer some questions now. And here we go. If you would like to ask us questions for these reviewed episodes, you can do so on our Discord, which I have mentioned already. You can find the link to on all of our socials. While we're doing those sorts of pluggy plug things, I'll go ahead and also say that we have merch at geekpantheon.com. And we have a Patreon, patreon.com/thegeekpantheon. Tiers start at $1. You have access to some of Eric and Philip's DM shenanigans behind the curtain. Some bonus episodes, some bonus videos from Eric. And then, and those are, I mean, I don't want to sell a false bill of goods. Those are not ongoing. They are occasional.
Yeah.
And 1,000 other things. Anyway, check out the Patreon. If you like it, spend some money. Here are those questions. We will start with a handful from Kevin. What regrets would Hob and Eris have in what's happened thus far in the campaign? Well, there's that one big one that we talked about.
Yeah, that. This doesn't exactly count. Eris is really, like, when we captured and turned over Norse and Milhatch at the beginning, and Eris accidentally, at the very last possible moment, blows their identity to Norsen after all of our careful work to prevent that from happening.
I forgot
that is a pretty big one. Eris regrets a lot of things to do with Harbin, but she honestly doesn't know what she should have done different. And I think that's often Eris's frustration with interpersonal things, is she knows she's screwed up with a lot of people, but she doesn't actually know what the right thing to have done was in most of these situations.
I think if Hob has a regret, it is that he did not realize the enormity of all of this when it was still in its infancy and there was actually some things we could have done about it.
Yeah.
He didn't catch the vibes off of Milhatch that he should have. He didn't catch the vibes off of Solomon Calloway that he should have. He knew Viggo was a little, you know, turd, but nothing, I don't believe there's anything we could have done to save Seda.
Right.
But the fallout from it, making sure that people knew that was something we wouldn't have done. Being a bigger against Calloway in public, not where Calloway was around, but among the clan or something, you know, things like that. I think that's what Hob regrets, is that he is surrounded by all of what's happening now because he didn't have the insight of where it was heading in the beginning. Whether he should have or not, that's how it feels.
Sure.
I call myself dumb a lot, and I stand by it. But Hob thinks he's smart. I don't think Hob's necessarily wrong either, and he just fully let this go. So I think if he were to have a regret, that would be it. And I'm sure there's a death that I can't remember right now that Hob would have not liked, would have liked to have not have happened.
Right.
Or a loss or something. Is there a particular moment in this campaign, Kevin continues, where you really felt like your character was in their element or at the peak of that melding of player and character?
This is so hard because there are places where I remember in the moment really wishing that I was in the heads, like the confrontation with the Dashur under the city was great. And Eric, man, the way Eric set it up and everything, it was so... So the way he sort of gradually foreshadowed what it would be, who we were going after and just different things like that was really cool. And having Olive there and everything. And I remember just feeling very in my own head throughout that and wishing that I could have just like let Eris flow in that moment, because I was stuck in the Eris hates this person and Eris is eternally grateful to this person, and I don't know what to do. I don't know how to communicate that contradictory feeling in a combat encounter right now, because without abandoning my friends to die. Eric saved me from that moment by having him hurt Olive, which flipped all the necessary switches to send Eris into a berserker rage. I guess kind of the opposite of that would be pretty much any time we've gotten to have a skiff chase combat, all of the different things that Eris has made really tend to shine when we get into vehicular combats of having Tasha and the different ways that Eris can screw with somebody else's vessel and the ridiculous things that we've gotten to do there. I think car chase Eris is probably the place where just everything I've built Eris to do really comes out in and shines.
I would say the time I feel like I'm playing the Hob I intended to play, the Hob that I built, is in, you know, when he's in minion crushing mode. Like that is the Hob that I created. Eric knew that. That's why he gave me that heroic ability.
Yeah.
So that is the time that I feel the most like Hob qua Hob that I wanted. To kind of rephrase, and I hope I still get the spirit of the question, as far as the melding thing, the most Jeff thing Hob does is swoop in at the end of a conversation and try to clear things up, whether it needs to. Okay, hang on. So what we're all saying here, just so we're all clear on this, like that is a very Jeff thing. Part of it has to do with working with teenagers every day.
Right.
Specifically teenagers who are supposed to be representing themselves to potential employers. I feel like I do a lot of that, which also leads to another very Jeff thing where he realizes that he kind of didn't get the gist of it and has to back up a little bit. But that's when I feel, and it's Jeff compelling it. But that's the most Jeff thing Hob does, is to like, well, no, that's not really, okay, that's not what we meant.
I mean, I built Eris to do this, but the most me part of Eris is absolutely just spouting random, obscure Eberron lore about goblins or things like that. Uh-huh. Like Eris was partly built because I had thought to play a goblin and then decided to play Eris, and I still wanted to use all my goblin lore. My favorite Hob as just the wrecking machine that he is in melee fighting is, well, the first time we went down into Fallen and we got attacked by those like acid creatures, like that thing that was that every time you hit it, it hit you with acid. Mm-hmm. And Hob just goes mad and punches it through a wall. Like that was perfect. That was just so, like, you could see the moment, you could see you could see the comic book panel of it. And that was immediately what went to my head. I was like, where is Hob just doing exactly what Hob is supposed to do? That was the episode that jumped into my head.
You know what I think would be interesting? If, you know, I'm going to put a question to the Discord. If anybody would like to get in there and answer this. What do you see as through lines between the characters that we've played between campaign one and campaign two?
Oh, that would be interesting.
We may not see. You know, my thing for, and this is just the way Philip plays. It really doesn't have anything to do with his character. Philip plays close to the vest until he gets a really good opportunity to show his new toy up, and it always blows. It's the most fun way to play it. I have to immediately tell him that. I'm like, look at this talent I got. Whereas Philip's like, I'm not saying anything until I do it. And it's the most fun thing in the world. Eris and Beric both would occasionally just do something. I'd be like, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Eris definitely is. It's much more in character with Eris than with Beric. I enjoyed it with Beric partly because it's fun to surprise Eric, but it was Eris. It's definitely much more in character because Eris absolutely would not tell you this new thing she made last night until she pulls it out from under her coat and blows something up with it. Like, just,
yes.
Yeah.
What's been your favorite part, Kevin? I'll tell you when it's not Kevin anymore. What's been your favorite part of playing this campaign in Genesis and your least favorite?
The way we've done Artifice. Eris is practically impossible to build in any other system and be the way she is. I came kind of close in Blades in the Dark just one time just to try, but D&D does not give the kind of free form crafting that is absolutely the core of everything Eris is able to do.
Yeah. Mine is definitely, I mean, it's a broad answer, but I just love the talent system.
Yeah.
I like feats in D&D, but I never take them because I don't like the trade-off. Especially if you're like, you know, one ability point away from raising up your modifier in something important. You know?
Right.
I'm never going to take silence as a feat or whatever, you know, when I could constantly be rolling, adding another digit.
Right.
Or whatever. So it's just that, like, building the character, refining the character. When I remember to spend XP, that's what I've enjoyed the most about playing in Genesis. And it is more a system thing than an actual gameplay thing, but it makes the gameplay that much more fun.
Yeah.
As far as least, I don't like despairs, but I don't feel like that's what you're asking.
Again, this is more a reality of the way that we play at Eric's table, either present, either physically or digitally, than it is. Well, this isn't really a Genesis thing, so it's not. I was going to say, I really like maps and tokens, but that's not a Genesis thing. That's just a nature of what we're doing thing. I don't know. I guess we've said it before. If we had known that we were going to spend a lot of the early part of this campaign not able to play at a table with each other, we'd have probably picked a different system because Genesis is just so much better when you're around a table. So maybe the fact that it doesn't transfer as well to playing remotely as other things do.
To put a very granular look on the question, though, what's been my favorite part of playing this campaign in Genesis is it lends itself well to the not world defining.
Yeah. Yeah.
Stuff. Mm-hmm. Like this system and this setting of being like, we're just going to focus on this much of Sharn works well together.
Yeah. If we were the equivalent, whatever the equivalent D&D level would be, there's no way Eris would be in danger as often as she is.
Yeah. We would be, if we would be world famous, you know, like we could still be in Sharn, but people would be coming to try to take us out.
Yeah.
This, you know,
we'd be invincible. Mm-hmm. And I like that we aren't.
What is your favorite dessert, baked good, and or pastry?
Okay, it's probably conditional. There are several, but if I'm going to pick one that I will just eat really any time, there's a pastry. It exists in a lot of different cuisines. I'm familiar with the Latin version of it, being from Texas. There's a pastry that's called an array, and it's basically just puffed pastry that's been cut thin and then sort of wrapped and folded into almost a heart shape. Oreja means an ear, and so it kind of looks like a pair of ears or a heart, depending on where your head is. And then it's drizzled in caramelized sugar and honey, and sometimes like cinnamon. Like, you can flavor it in a lot of different ways, but it's really simple and it's really, really good. And there used to be a grocery store here that just kept them in the bakery aisle. They would just bake them fresh and put them out, and they were real cheap. And so I would just go by there and just buy a dozen and bring them home sometimes. And that place closed down, and I haven't found another good place in my area to get them, but I love those. They're so good. It's probably okay that I can't buy them by the dozen anymore, because it's hard not to just eat them like Oreos.
That's funny. I'll take any baked good that is either lemon, blueberry, or orange cranberry flavored. I will take and be, those are my two favorite flavor combinations, period. And they happen to exist in pastries. So I'm also will never turn down a plain glazed donut. I'm not that fancy.
It's true.
What NPC has felt the most like a chore to interact with? Kevin's final question. That's very funny. Vigo? I mean,
right. I don't know. I mean, for Eris, it was definitely Ace. Like, Eris had a very hard time tolerating Ace because he required patience, and that's not her thing. She's the person that everyone is supposed to use their patience on.
Patience
is something that happens to Eris, not the other way around. For me, I don't know how to answer. I can't think of one that Eric brings out, and I'm just like, I mean, I guess a little bit that horrible doctor. Like the things that Eric has chosen to start doing with that voice.
Oh, what
just
was
make
name?
My skin crawl.
That's going to kill me. I will not think of it. There's no point in even trying. I mean, late Kath is a bummer to deal with.
Oh, yeah.
Honestly, Eric knows when he's making an NPC a chore for me and will lean into it sometimes because if Hob is making sense and the NPC is just not agreeing with him out of spite, that's a chore for Jeff. And Eric knows that. Anytime Eric points at me, that is a chore for that NPC.
The smug, pedantic villain is what Eric does to needle me. And he's good at it. He's so good at it. Oh my gosh. Eric is really good at monologuing as a villain.
And to be fair, next time Eric is on, I will give him an opportunity to say what things Philip and I do.
I was going
to
say, surely that, it goes both ways. But.
And again, it will be the same thing that we know annoy him. I just don't know what it is. I have to be in the moment to realize it. But I'm sure there's things I do on purpose.
I would guess it's when I, and this is, I swear this is almost always accidental, when I bring up some bit of Eberron lore that contradicts something that just happened in the narrative. Because usually it happens because I'm seeking clarification. And then I realize, oh, shut up, you jerk. This is Eric's Eberron. Don't bother him about books.
You know, I meant to say earlier, that is one thing in the confluence of Hob and Jeff is they will both derail whatever's happening for the sake of a joke that may or may not be true. Okay, Irene has a question. What, for both of you, what's your favorite part about parenting a teenager?
Mine still likes dressing up in costumes.
Yeah, my kids are just still. Honestly, my favorite thing about raising a teenager right now is they both, I'm very lucky, I did not try to force this, but they both got into the extracurriculars that I enjoyed into in high school. And so getting to experience that with them.
Yeah, it is really hard not to try and force that because like I really want Rose to love D&D and board games and she likes some of them and she likes the social activity of it, but it's just not right now. It's not like her favorite thing. She likes the idea of it a lot more than she ends up liking the execution of it. But
you know, in the last two weekends, I got to watch Ferris play Pugsley in the Addams Family and Aubrey play Janice in Mean Girls at the
Gosh, that's so cool. Like it's so just, good.
It's wonderful getting to watch them do things that I did, but develop their own personality for it, do it their own way. They're both much better at it than I was at their respective ages. That's for sure. And then the other thing is just, you know, I enjoy all of the standard teenage tropes that I was expecting to get to deal with as a teenager. Like I told Philip earlier today when we were scheduling this, he said, what time? I don't want to interrupt your dinner time. And I said, I don't have a dinner time. I have a Ferris puts down the controller and says, do we have any food? And that's when I feed.
Specific to teen stuff, I really like her getting older because I get to introduce her to new media that I like. Well, there's so many more movies I can watch with her at 15.
Yes.
Than you know, in the past. And so that's a real joy is not having to like go through my mind of this movie I'd really like to share with her and think, is this gonna ruin her night's sleep for the next week?
Yeah.
And getting to take her to more movies too. Like getting to look at a rating and say, okay, well this is rated that, so I can take her whether I know the content thoroughly ahead of time or not. Mm-hmm. And most of the time that doesn't backfire.
At the very least, anything that comes up here, we can safely talk through.
Yes, exactly. Yeah,
I do want to be clear. Ferris will not be a teenager for like two more months, but I'm counting it. He's always been pretty mature.
Man, they start being a teen before that suffix gets added to the number.
Yeah. When I was a youth minister, there was a kid in the youth group that was like 12, and he said, "Actually, I'm a tween." And I go, "You do not want to correct people with that. Just take it." Laura asks, "Is Hob okay?" And Flame
she asks, actually asks if Hanb is okay.
I was gonna let it slide, but I don't think they would let it slide with me. So
yeah.
So they ask, "Is Hanb okay?" And Flame asks, is Jeff okay? And the answer is, you'll see. And yeah, more or less.
Yeah.
Jeff, I don't want to gloss over. I was genuinely concerned about the reaction that this was going to have. Like, it was in my mind from the moment it happened until the episode released. Mm-hmm. So, Laura wants to know if we think Ace and Kath were which led to a discussion about, wasn't Ace a child? I always assumed Ace was... would have been at Moorgrave University if he had had a different life.
Yeah, I always assumed Ace was I pictured Ace younger than Eris, which would make him, I guess, very late teens. because Eris is...
We have an unspoken thing. Eric is going to let us know
if
this is not a character we should be treating like an adult.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if down the road he's like, this 14-year-old, and we've like said things that we should only say to or about adults.
Well,
he's,
or he suddenly reveals that Ace is 14 after you've punched a hole in his chest. Like,
yes.
Right.
So I believe Laura continues, how old is Ace? How old was Ace?
Right. We're going to go with 18. I'm going to go with 18 because that feels about right.
That's fair. I was going to say 21.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, he is firmly an adult, but a young one.
Yes.
Okay. Laura wants to know, what is your favorite nostalgia book? And I, not being in the internet book world, I don't know if that's an actual thing.
It didn't even occur to me to check whether that's a specific thing. I assumed that meant like a book you like because you liked it a long time ago, regardless of its merits.
I think that's kind of what I was thinking. I assumed it wasn't a book that makes you think about the past.
I read a lot of those.
Yeah.
That's my jam. This is really hard because most of the books that have stuck with me, like I'm going to have to let go of the regardless of its merits thing, because most of the books that really affected me as a kid, I reread on a regular basis because I still love them. And I think they're still as meaningful as adults. I'm going to cheat and offer two because they're big for me in different ways. And I'm setting aside the ones that anyone who knows anything about me would immediately list as obvious. Lord of the Rings is not a nostalgia book. That's a current fascination.
It's an evergreen book.
That's a lifestyle. I'm going to go with The Jungle Book. It was one because my dad loved The Jungle Book growing up, and he passionately hated the Disney adaptation because it's so far from the books. And so he read us pieces of The Jungle Book from a very young age, and so I have a lot of memories of sitting on the floor while my dad reads us stories out of The Jungle Books, or he read us pieces of a lot of classics that he carefully curated. It was a while before I knew that Ka made all the monkeys walk down his throat to their deaths, but you know, carefully curated ones, especially Rikki Tikki Tavi was the Kipling story that I remember my dad reading and just being enamored of. So I'm going to say The Jungle Book. I still like it. I still think it's good literature, but it is part of my love for it is warm feelings of childhood. And then there's a classicist and historical fiction writer named Mary Renault, who was a British writer who died back in the 80s. She wrote a book, I think in the 1950s, it's called The Lion in the Gateway, and it's about the war between the Greeks and the Persians in the 5th century BC. And I didn't realize until much later, it's not historical fiction. It's just a narrative telling of a series of historical events. Like it's just she's just narrating what happened instead of providing a fictional narrative within that setting. And it was really well into adulthood before I realized that defined what I like about history, because I hate academic history writing. Like I hate it. It's so boring. History is this cool series of stories. Like I have a book that has a letter from a Sumerian bureaucrat to his king explaining why it's taking him so long to find a lion for the king's zoo. And the reason is that the lion they had found got loose and got stuck in somebody's attic, and it took them 4 days to get it. And so reading that book when I was, I think, in sixth or seventh grade, I still got my copy of that book when I was in sixth or seventh grade, really set what I loved about history, which was this is an amazing and dramatic story about remarkable people and also regular people doing remarkable things. And that has defined my teaching style as a history teacher and lots of other things about it. So I would say that is one that I don't reread because it's very much for children, but it has a lot of impact on me. So
similarly, one of mine, the book that I remembered reading as a child that I loved and was excited to introduce to Ferris as he got old enough to read it and does hold up, is Jerry Spinelli's Maniac McGee.
Oh, that's such a good book.
Fantastic book.
Yeah.
I probably read it.
Rose read it for school, and that was, mm-hmm. I remembered it. It's such a good book.
Because, you know, I was of reading age when it was published. I believe it was up for a Newbery that year, and that's why I read it, 90 or 91 or something. And like 30 years later, a Ferris read it, and it was still very good. So that one, a book I haven't read in a long time that I loved that I can't imagine doesn't hold up is The Outsiders. And then the only book I've revisited four books in my life. I've only reread that I can think of. Well, one of them is The Chronicles of Narnia. So that's
sure
a little different. It's very recent, but I've gone back to it several times. I just love it. I've reread Andy Weir's The Martian.
Oh, that's so good.
Probably
that's such a good book.
Six or eight times, including audiobook.
Yeah.
It's just the way he writes is so, you know, it's funny. I haven't read his follow up. I guess it's not a follow up to The Martian, but his second book I still haven't read. But the way he wrote The Martian was just so pleasant and colloquial and enjoyable that I just pick it up to, you know, feel nice. So
it's triumph of the human spirit. It's like, you know, it's the definition of that. Yeah, I agree. The Martian is very rereadable.
And the movie really holds up as
does. A
really good adaptation. I was very happy with all the Martian things. Lastly, Gus Seven has a couple of questions. With the loss that Hob has experienced over the course of the campaign, do you see him drifting back towards his Blood of Vol faith or turning away from it? Hob's Blood of Vol faith is constantly in a spin cycle. He returns and runs from it as he needs to remain stoic and sane and grounded. I think that's been his kind of thing his whole life. You know, I don't do a lot of narrating of Hob's alone time and downtime, but he very much still does his meditations and things when he needs to. So I think it'll always be a thing that he keeps at arm's length, both because he doesn't want it too close and needs to be able to drag it near when he wants to.
Yeah.
Not too terribly different from my own relationship with the faith I grew up with, if I'm being honest. But I think that's, so I don't think that he'll do either. You know, Hobbs' loss in this campaign is not drastically different from any loss that one might have over their lifetime. You know, in the life that he leads, a nomadic fighter's lifestyle. So I think that's where he's going to be. And lastly, from Gus Seven, now that we've gone far past campaign one's length, how has it been still playing relatively low stakes after such a long time?
I love it. Like I'm at this stage in campaign one, and we've said this before, this is not a surprise. At this stage in campaign one, I was, well, obviously we're way past it, but when we got to the end of campaign one, I was very ready for it to be over. Mm-hmm. I was ready to stop playing Barrack. I was ready to not deal with the fact that the world is on our shoulders. Like it was just, it got so heavy. I love the low level play that we're getting.
I think one of the things that is fun about it and one of the great ironies of this is we have so much more to keep track of now that we haven't left town than we did when we spent most of our time on a boat with the same seven people flitting all over the world.
Right.
That it has become such a bigger story in such a smaller geography. Is something that I think is a lot of fun. Like, I don't feel like we're playing a small story. We're just playing it in a small arena.
I really love the fixed setting. I thought I might miss traveling around to other places in Eberron, but I have not. I really loved the fixed story and the way that we've gotten to grow to know the different parts of town. Like, it's been very, I think that's great. And Eric has done such a good job of making that alive.
And I think that's part of it is Eric has done an unbelievable job of saying, now we're going to go to the crud it was called, Midnight Vale, something Vale.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a new nightclub that I came up with, and here's the menu.
Yeah.
And so even inside of town, we have there's a constellation in our town. So it's pretty wonderful. And I always end up, when he's not here, I'm nice about him, and I don't like it. But yeah, I would say that, not to quibble, it feels more less low stakes because we've invested so much more in the personal lives of the characters that even though what is happening in Sharn is low stakes on a cosmic scale, it seems very high stakes in our little cauldron. So way to go, Eric, I guess. Thank you all for your questions. Thank you all for listening. We will be back next week. Philip, any last thing you want to get out there that we may have glossed over?
No, I'm excited for them to hear what's coming.
Yeah, it's good. I don't say that about it. I believe it, but I don't say it very often. I'm excited for you guys to hear what's coming up. And we will be back next Friday with another episode. Until then, I have been Jeff.
And I'm Philip.
Wonderful. Whatever the rest of your day looks like when you're done with this. Goodbye.